Tonight I'm very pleased to welcome Jesus Reyes, who will discuss bioaccumulation of contaminant chemicals in California's coastal aquatic environments. Jesus Reyes co-founded and serves as the president of the Pacific Coast Environmental Conservancy, which conducts environmental research and monitoring and has developed an environmental education and outreach program that focuses on engaging middle and high school students in environmental sciences. Reyes attended California State University, Long Beach, earning bachelor's degrees in marine biology and zoology. His thesis research, which led to a master's degree of biology with a focus on environmental toxicology and endocrinology, was among the earliest studies in California to document environmental impacts associated with coastal wastewater discharges on endocrine systems of wild fishes. Reyes also teaches courses in environmental, marine, and physiological sciences at Cal State Long Beach and other regional colleges. It's my pleasure to welcome Jesus Reyes.
All right, well, first, I want to thank Kathy for that introduction. I also want to thank Linda Brown, who I've been talking to for the last month or so, and I want to thank her for giving me this opportunity to come talk to you guys about the research that my organization does. I also want to thank the Aquarium Group for putting up this summer series of speakers, which has been really, really awesome. I know one of my cohorts and one of my dear friends, Eric Zahn, gave a talk earlier last month, so it's been great that the Aquarium Pacific is able to do that. So what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to talk to you guys about how my organization focuses on human impacts and how we investigate and research the ways that humans impact not only the marine environments, but also the organisms living in those environments. Now, for many, many years, research has been done on these environments to look at what the contaminants are. We can measure mercury, we can measure lead, we can measure aluminum, we can measure pesticides, right? But it wasn't until just maybe a handful of years ago that we started really looking at how those contaminants actually act on the animals that live in those environments. And that's what I'm going to do tonight. But one great thing about California is that it's a great state. I'm sure nobody here will argue that California is an awesome state. We have beautiful coastlines. Unfortunately, California also has two distinct areas where large human populations interface with the marine environment in a very, very large scale. We have Southern California to your left, and we have the Bay Area to your right. Both locations are highly populated. And it's the actions and the activities of these humans on a daily basis that cause there to be water quality issues. Now, for us, it may not be such a concern, but the inhabitants of these areas have to deal with these water quality issues. So for many years, we have been doing research in these areas. We've been looking at things like legacy contaminants. And legacy contaminants are any sort of contaminant or pollutant that stays in the environment for a prolonged period of time. In some cases, hundreds of years. Things like DDT and PCBs. We've also been measuring things like metals and materials. As I mentioned, mercury, also things like nanomaterials. It's something that has been sort of popping up in the last handful of years, is something that we know as contaminants of emerging concern, also known as CECs. These are chemicals that in some cases have been around for a pretty long time, but it wasn't until just recently that we've gotten information and data to suggest that these contaminants are having a really deleterious effect on not only the environments that these animals live in, but the animals themselves. And these include things like pharmaceuticals and current use pesticides. Well, again, California's great. You look at Southern California, and we have a very unique environment here in Southern California. We have something called the Southern California Bite, which extends from Point Conception all the way down to Baja California. Okay? Within this environment, we have a lot of people living there. And I'm sure we know that because we bump into all of them when we're driving home from work, right? There's a ton of people living in Southern California. If you look at LA City and LA County, you have about 10 million people living in this region. Then you add about 3 million people living in Orange County, and then over 2 million people living in Riverside. You add to that that both on the north and the south end of Southern California, we have a large human population in Ventura County, as well as San Diego County. Overall, within the Southern California Bight, we're looking at 20 million human beings. 20 million human beings, which on a daily basis, their actions and their activities have some sort of impact on the marine environment. What sort of impacts do we have? Well, we have a ton of impacts. We have a lot of impacts. Okay? One of them, unfortunately, is something that we have to do on a daily basis. Okay? We have to get rid of our waste. Okay? And that's not just waste. It's also the hormones that our body does not need. Anything the body does not use, does not need, it's released into the environment, whether it be chemicals, hormones, medicines, what have you. Okay? There are other things that may play a role in some of this waste. Right. Not so much this guy here, because I've never really seen elephants in LA, but you get the gist of it. There's other things that may play a role in the waste that's being discharged into our environment. So you might think, well, that's some pretty nasty stuff, okay? But we do have some wastewater treatment plants within the Southern California body that do a really good job of making sure that they get rid of the biosolid waste, making sure that they eliminate the bacteria that goes out into the water. Okay. Here within the body, we have three large major wastewater treatment plants. We have Hyperion Treatment Plant, which services the city of LA. We have Joint Waters Pollution Control Plant, which services the rest of LA County. And we also have Orange County Sanitation District, which services most of Orange County. Okay. These guys do a very good job, again, of eliminating that biosolid and that bacterial waste. Okay. They do such a great job that Hyperion Treatment Plant and Joint Waters treat and discharge about 350 million gallons of treated wastewater into marine environments every single day. Okay? Orange County Sanitation deals with about 250 million gallons of treated wastewater back into the environment every single day. But it's not the stuff that they're putting out into the environment that's the problem. It's the rest of the stuff that we add to that wastewater that's the issue. So what are we adding to that wastewater that's such a big deal? Well, I've already mentioned one of these. It's pharmaceutical agents, things like detergents, things like herbicides and pesticides, things like caffeine, and baby bottles and babies. Right. Not so much the bottles and the clothes themselves, but the chemicals that go into those products. Okay? Baby bottles are laden with BPA, which is a very harmful chemical. And a lot of baby clothes, and I'm just not picking on baby clothes, but a lot of everything has something called PVDs, something known as flame retardants. Okay? My shirt has it, my slacks have it, cell phone has it, chairs have it, it's in everything. And it's in everything to make sure that things just don't go up in flames. Okay? So those chemicals have been shown to be very detrimental to not only the environments, but the organisms living within those environments. And a lot of these are daily use chemicals, which are also known as CEC. These chemicals of emerging concern. Some of these have been around for a very long time. Caffeine has been around for a very long time, and yet just recently have we gotten results to show that caffeine is very detrimental to the organisms living in the environment. So contaminants of emerging concerns cover a large group of chemicals. Okay? There's over 100,000 chemicals in current use today, whether it's in manufactured goods, in medicines, or in chemicals that you use in your household appliances, and to wash your dishes and to wash your cars. Okay? There's a rapid pace of development for these new chemicals, which many of them are designed to be active in organisms. Okay? And that's to say that every year we develop about 1,000 new chemicals that get put into manufactured goods, get put into the detergents and the soaps that you use, and even into medicines that you may use as well. Okay? So these CECs are increasingly being detected in our environments. And yet with over 100,000 chemicals, and new 1,000 chemicals being produced every year, less than 130 of these chemicals are actually regulated as a priority water pollutant. That's pretty crazy. So what are the environmental fates of these chemicals? Are they active in the environment? Are they going to be hurtful to the organisms in that environment? And in turn, are they going to be hurtful to us? These are questions that we have yet to answer because we're producing so many chemicals so rapidly. So PCC, one of the things we do is we try to go out there and monitor as many of the different environments as we can. We try to monitor as many of the organisms living in those environments as we can. And we also try to answer this question. How many of these new chemicals are really having a negative effect? Okay? Are there CECs in Southern California waters? You bet. Okay? This is a very, very small list of the CECs that are found, not only in the effluent, which is the water that's getting released into the marine environment, but also in the marine environment itself. It covers everything from antibacterial soap to different hormones to industrial agents, all the way down to medicine. And that's a very small list. So a lot of the stuff that we're using is being detected out in the environment. So with 20 million people and essentially 20 million urinators, what are the actual impacts on this environment? Well, I've already mentioned that within the Southern California Bight, we have three large wastewater treatment plants. These three wastewater treatment plants are not only some of the largest in the country, they're actually some of the largest wastewater treatment plants in the world. And so they do a very, very tough job. And their job is to basically treat the waste that we produce and release it back into the environment a lot cleaner than they get it. And they do a great job of that. To the point that these three wastewater treatments combined are less than about 45 miles away from each other, and yet in total, they release nearly 1 billion gallons of treated wastewater back into the environment every single day. That's an immense amount, and they do a great job at it. But which one of those environmental contaminants, either whether they be legacy contaminants or CECs, have a negative effect on the wildlife that we look at? Well, one of the things my organization does is that we look at sensitive diagnostic methodologies that we utilize to measure these things. And some of the chemicals that we're measuring are chemicals, as I mentioned, that are just slowly coming up as being chemicals of some sort of concern. And so we're using state-of-the-art technologies to try to detect these chemicals and doing what's called bioanalytical screening. That's something that uses the organisms themselves. So essentially what we do is we do something called animal phenotype. And we ask the animal itself. We go to the site, we go to the environment, and we tell the animal, tell me what's wrong with you. So we do that by measuring the physiology of these animals, and we are able to get a better understanding of the environmental effects, specifically when it comes to water quality. Because I mentioned that everything that we do has an impact back into the marine environment. We do that two ways. First, we measure the endocrine response of the organism. That is, we measure hormones, we measure anything that deals with environmental endocrinology. The second phase of that deals with tissue expression response. And we do that by measuring the proteins of the organism as well as the genes. Because we know that there might be an effect at the endocrine level, but we also want to make sure that the cells and the tissues that regulate those systems are also doing well. And that's where the endocrine system kind of comes in. My organization really focuses on endocrinology, and you might say, well, what's the big deal with endocrinology and why is the endocrine system so big, so important? Well, the endocrine system regulates a lot of the important physiological functions that we all have. They regulate things like reproduction, growth, metabolism, your immunity, development, and your stress response. Those are some major key physiological functions. As long as these things are working properly, the organism will be under homeostasis, which means the organism is going to be nice and happy, and it'll be nice and healthy. If these systems are working properly, that means the organism is going to be able to adapt to its environment if the environment changes with no problem. And if these things are working properly, then that organism is going to be able to survive. Okay? These are some very important physiological mechanisms right here. I'm sure that if you were to go to someone that you knew and said, hey, I'm going to mess up your reproduction, I'm going to screw with your stress, I'm going to totally mess up your development, and I'm also going to mess with your metabolism and your immunity, they probably wouldn't be too happy. But those are some very, very important physiological mechanisms. So anything that disrupts this system is known as an environmental endocrine disruption. Okay? These chemicals have the ability to alter the growth, the reproduction, the stress, the immunity, and the developmental systems of these organisms. So that's what my organization focuses on. One of the main environmental endocrine disruptors are environmental estrogens. Okay? Whether they be natural estrogens like estradiol, or whether they be synthetic ones like the legacy contaminants that I've talked about, DDT, PCB, and the chemical of emerging concern, nonylphenol. Regardless of what it is, if these chemicals somehow impact the reproductive axes of these organisms, then reproduction is going to be affected. So, one of the things that I did when I was a grad student at Cal State Long Beach is that I looked at how humans impact these marine organisms, and I focused on marine fish. What I did, one of the things I did, I should say, because I did about four things, one of the things I did was that I looked at estrogen levels in male flatfish of Southern California. So when you look at a male organism, a male vertebrate, whether it's a fish, whether it's a cow, whether it's a horse, a giraffe, or a human, every male vertebrate should only have about 50 picograms per male of estrogen or less. And as you can see, I measured these male flatfish species, and they fall well within that 50 picogram per male range. Then there's this horny-head turbid, another flatfish. And obviously you see that there are no bars here, so you can guess what the results are going to be. We measured this fish. Not only did we see males having very high levels of estrogen, they had higher levels than females, which at the time was kind of unheard of. What did these levels do? Well, one of the things we also measured was that we saw that those males that had high levels of estrogen also showed a special protein called vitellogen. Now, vitellogen is a protein that's found in the yolk of the eggs. So females lay eggs, so they definitely have a lot of vitellogen. Males, they're not supposed to lay eggs, yet they still have vitellogen. Okay? But probably the most insane result that we got from this project, and I want to make sure I get this clear. This project had us sample hundreds of fish, specifically hundreds of males. Okay? And a small subset of those males, about 9 males that we sampled, gave us this result over here. And what this result is that within those males, about 9 of them, we were able to detect both testicular tissue and ovarian tissue within the same animal, which means that they had something called ovotestis. Okay? Doesn't happen rapidly, doesn't happen in all males, but we were able to find a small subset of males where this was expressed, all because of exposure to this contaminant. So one of the other things we saw in this study was that we noticed regional differences as we went north from Orange County. Remember I mentioned those 3 large sanitation districts? Well, as we measured up from Orange County into the Santa Monica Bay Area, we noticed that estrogen levels skyrocketed. So we asked ourselves, is there some sort of wastewater treatment plant influence going on here? So we went out and we did a larger base study, which brought in more collaborators, which I'm happy to say was published in a journal last year. And we worked really hard to make sure that we got the answer correct. Okay, because we could go out and make assumptions, but we wanted to make sure that we got the right answer. And what we determined was that it's not specifically linked to any wastewater treatment plant outfall. Now, an outfall is an area right where every wastewater treatment plant basically discharges or releases their water into the environment. A far field site is a site obviously farther away from that. So you would expect that at those outfall sites where most of the stuff's coming out, you would see high incidences of all of these chemicals. And for most of these areas, you do. But in some areas like Palos Verdes, it turns out that the far field site has slightly higher levels than you do at the outfall site. So we can't necessarily say that it's connected to every wastewater treatment plant outfall. But what we did still see was that regional difference where as you go up from Orange County, you see increasing levels of fish exhibiting these high levels of estrogen in their system. One of the other things we asked ourselves was, all right, if these fish are exhibiting high levels of estrogen, is that estrogen having some sort of impact on the male hormones? And the answer is no. Ironically, these fish have normal levels of both testosterone and the more important fish male hormone, 11-ketotestosterone. And the black bars you see are the samples taken during the spring when there's a reproductive season. So you actually see the males acting normal, okay? Which is a great sign. So overall, we knew that we saw males with high levels of estrogen. We saw that the levels significantly changed as you went from Orange County all the way up to Santa Monica Bay. But we also determined that the levels are not linked with the wastewater treatment plant outfall site, which is a key point. And we also noticed that it had no impairment on the male hormones that you saw in the fish. But it still begs the question, what are the environmental causes of these differences? Why is it that the horny-head turbid is the only flatfish that shows highly elevated levels of estrogen in their systems? And why is it that none of the other fish do? So these are questions that we are still currently investigating and we're still currently looking at. So it's work that's still ongoing. So at the beginning of my talk, I mentioned that California has two sites where you have this large human population that impacts the marine environment. The other site is the Bay Area, okay? And you can see all that nice concrete color there. That's all humans. So up in San Francisco, we look at a different focus. We look at thyroid hormones. Thyroid hormones, also known as T4 and T3, are really important hormones. They regulate things like brain and neural development, and they also regulate things like somatic growth. And they're important regulators of metabolism as well. But these two middle points are probably the more important ones, okay? If you're an organism and you don't develop correctly neurally, then you're probably not going to be able to hunt as well, and you're probably not going to be able to avoid predators as well, because you haven't really learned the proper methods to do so. And if your growth is affected, long term, that may have some very negative effects as well. Unlike humans, fish have indeterminate growth. So they just keep growing and growing. They don't grow crazy, but they keep growing and growing. And when it comes to reproduction, fecundity is also reliant on how big fish are. So the bigger the female, the more eggs she's going to lay. Smaller the female, the less eggs. So if you have some sort of disruption in this system here, where growth is being impaired, and in the long term, you're also talking about population sizes being impaired overall. Now, up north, we focus on two native fish species, shiner perch and Pacific staghorn sculpin. These are two really good species to use as a model for investigating thyroid disruption up in the Bay Area for one reason, and it's it's a habitat that they live in. Shiner perch live in the water column, so they swim in the water. Staghorn sculpin live at the very bottom. So if there's a difference in the contaminants and how the contaminants affect the organisms, we're going to see it between these two species. If a contaminant tends to be found mostly in the water column and is water soluble, then this guy's going to be affected more than this guy, and vice versa. So if a contaminant is linked to organic material in the sediment, then this guy should be more affected compared to this guy. So it's a really good model to use. So what we did is we went up to San Francisco Bay and we sampled a multitude of sites. If anyone has been up to the Bay Area or is, you know, familiar with this area, then you know some of these sites. We went to Redwood City, San Leandro Bay, Oakland, Richmond, Richmond-Richmond Channel, San Pablo Bay, San Francisco Waterfront, Hunters Point. We also went up to Bodega Bay and Tamales Bay, which is not on this map, it's further up here. And what we found was that when you take these two species and you measure their thyroid hormones from a place like Redwood City and Tamales Bay, for both of these species, you get what look like to be normal thyroid levels. Obviously, I don't have a bar for Oakland, so you can guess what you see at Oakland, right? These fish have their thyroid system being impacted. And that means they don't have the ability to produce the normal thyroid hormones that you see in fish from other locations. Has anyone been to Oakland here? Very industrial, okay? It's a great place, don't get me wrong, but very industrial, okay? So we decided, well, we saw some disruption, let's go back and sample some more sites. So we brought in our study and we went back up and we did multiple sites. And then something popped up that was very interesting. We saw that there were two other sites that also showed thyroid disruption. And ironically, those sites also showed high levels of PCBs, which were those legacy contaminants. So not only do we see high levels of PBDs up there as well because of the high human population, but you also have PCBs at these locations which exhibit an impacted thyroid system. So, if you were to compare a city like Redwood City and a place like Oakland, there's almost no comparison. Redwood City tends to have a more natural-looking environment. Oakland, as I mentioned earlier, very industrial. So one of the other things we looked at in collaboration with Dr. Kevin Kelly's lab at Cal State Long Beach is we looked at the thyroid follicles. And this work is being done by a student named Evan Lee, who's here tonight, so I'll give credit for that. And what he's done is he looked at the thyroid follicles of fish representative of these two locations. And what he's done is he's stained them in different manners. But what you see is that when you take shiners from Redwood City, large thyroid follicles, right? And it's the thyroid follicles that are producing this hormone, the thyroid hormone. When you look at Oakland, very small thyroid follicles. So the contaminants that these fish are facing is causing these cells to basically diminish in size. Now, you might look at these contaminants and say, okay, well, We know we found PCBs up at Oakland. That's what PCB looks like. It's a legacy contaminant. I mentioned that PBDEs are found in the environment as well. Here's PBDE. If you look at thyroid hormone, you can see why there's a disruption going on. The hormones and the chemicals look identical. So these chemicals are basically interfering with the natural process of the hormone. So in this study, we were able to find thyroid endocrine disruption, which is associated with contamination exposure. That led to a reduced level in thyroid hormone due to PCB exposure. And true, that also leads to an impaired thyroid synthesis of thyroid hormone, which means those thyroid follicles don't have the ability to produce the natural levels of thyroid hormones that you see in other locations. But is that the end of the story? Well, not really. I mentioned earlier that every year we're producing thousands of new chemicals. So it'd be nice for me to stand up and say, hey, we only have to worry about PCB and PBDEs up north. That'd be a lie. There's hundreds of chemicals that are not only affecting this system, but affecting the stress system of the fish, affecting the reproductive systems of the fish, and the developmental systems of the fish. I was only given an hour to talk today, so I can't go into all that stuff, but trust me, there's a ton of stuff that I could be talking about. Okay? The study that we did do up in San Francisco, though, also got published, which I'm happy to say was put into aquatic toxicology, and it's a nice little read. If anybody needs a stocking stuffer for Christmas, it's on the web. Use that, it's really nice. But you might be thinking to yourself, okay, is Northern California the only location where we see thyroid disruption? And the answer is no. Down here in Southern California, as I've already mentioned, immense human population. So what we've done is we've also measured thyroid hormones down here in Southern California. Now, I want to point something out. You see this bar on Dana Point? It says reference, quote unquote, or in parentheses, clean area. There is no clean area left on Earth. Okay? Because of the daily activities that we've done and everything that we release into the environment, there's no location you can go on Earth where you won't find traceable levels of something. So there is no real clean site. And even the word reference, we have to usually use in quotation marks. So I may say reference and I might not do this, but just picture me doing this. Because okay? In reality, there's no real reference site. But the EPA does use this site, Alpha Dana Point, as their reference site. And what we saw at this reference site is that we measured thyroid hormone levels in horny head turbot, and you see that they show some pretty nice levels, something that we would consider normal. We go to every other site in Southern California, and you see that same thyroid impairment, an inability for these fish to produce normal thyroid hormone. Well, thyroid isn't the only thing we also look at. We also look at stress and how the stress axis of these organisms is disrupted. So when you look at the stress axis, this is known as the hypothalamic pituitary interrenal axis, also known as the HPI axis for those nerds out there. So the way the system works is that there's usually a stressor that goes on in the environment, like right now. I'm feeling this right here. That stressor will act on the hypothalamus to release something called a corticotropic releasing hormone. That will act on the anterior pituitary to then release adrenal corticotropic hormone, which will act on the interrenal tissues to release cortisol. You want cortisol in your system when you're dealing with a stressful event. It's cortisol that's going to get you through that. And cortisol has a slew of secondary physiological and behavioral responses, but one of the main ones is to get you through that stressful event. So if you're stressed, you should have high levels of cortisol. But is that what we see? Okay, organisms that are chronically stressed have impaired cortisol production. And every fish, or at least I should say almost every fish that we sampled, exhibits this. Horny head turbot, Pacific cyclone sculpin, China perch, and even California sculpin. So we've gone to what we call reference sites and measured the stress levels of these fish. Now these fish are dragged in a net and then basically brought up to the surface, which is like taking a human, dragging them on the floor, and then taking them up to space. Very, very stressful event. So they should have high levels of cortisol. So at those reference sites, you see that. You see a nice stress response. But then you go to those contaminated outfall sites, and it's about half. And if you go closer to the shore where humans love to interact with the environment, even worse. Okay? They don't have the ability to produce the normal stress response that you should see, in these fish. I mentioned a few minutes ago that I have a ton of stuff I could talk about. I'm going to take a little tangent. I did a collaborative project with a cohort of mine named Julie Coleman. She's a parasitologist. And one of the things we did with this fish right here, California scorpion fish, was look at how many parasites can impact this fish from a clean site to a dirty site. Not even clean site, reference site to a dirty site. And so we went to these reference sites, normal stress response, normal levels of cortisol, very few parasites. We went to the contaminated sites, no cortisol, hundreds of parasites. In fact, I believe in one fish, she was able to pull out over 1,000 parasites. Which shows you that when you impact the stress axis of this organism, everything else goes haywire. Its immunity goes down. And all the other systems are going to be impacted. And so things like pHs, PCBs, and salicylate, which is found in Roundup, have very negative effects on the stress response of these organisms, the immunity of these organisms, fuel metabolism, and the ability for these organisms to grow. These are all negative impacts that occur to the due to the exposure of these contaminants at these contaminated sites. So we decided to look at this up in San Francisco, and lo and behold, no surprise. Those fish that come from contaminated sites like Oakland also have the inability to produce a normal stress response. And so all the contaminants these fish are facing is causing not only their developmental systems to be impacted, but also their stress axis to be impacted. So now we get to someplace closer to home, okay? Colorado Lagoon. If you're native of Long Beach, you should know where Colorado Lagoon is. I'm not native of Long Beach, and I know where Colorado Lagoon is, okay? You look at this environment, it's a beautiful environment. This is a picture taken back in the 1930s, pristine environment. You see the Colorado Lagoon area in the background here, connected by this large waterway out to what we now know as Marine Stadium, which then eventually leads out to the ocean. Great place. We look at Colorado Lagoon now, drastically different. Okay? The environment has now been surrounded by a large area of development, a lot of people. The lagoon has since then been cut off from that waterway that connects it to the natural areas known as Marine Stadium, and has been replaced by an underground connection that's a fraction of what it naturally used to be. Okay? And unfortunately, over the years, Colorado Lagoon essentially became a sink, where street runoff and storm drains would basically go into it. Okay? And it wasn't until a few years ago that a group called Tidal Influence, which I know the guys from, and one of them was here, got together with the Friends of Colorado Lagoon and said, you know what, we gotta do something, this is wrong. And they fought, and they were able to build a restoration plan to get this thing back to a more natural state. And so what we did is we partnered up with them and said, look, we will go in and we will measure the fish, and we will monitor the endocrine systems of these fish to make sure that they're actually healthy. And so one of the things we've done is that not only have we sampled at Colorado Lagoon, but we've also sampled at sites that go further away from the lagoon. And what we found is that when you look at thyroid hormone levels in both shiner perch and stegosculpin from the lagoon, you see very, very low levels, levels that show some sort of impact. When you go further away from the lagoon and you go to Marine Stadium, you see an increased level in those thyroid hormones. And you go even further to Catalina Island, you see what we consider to be normal levels. And so we see a difference in thyroid hormone levels as you go further away from this contaminated site. Now, what PCC does is that we use multiple measures approach. And I think you've gotten sort of an idea of what we do. We don't just measure one thing, because that probably wouldn't be good science. There's a lot of things at play here. The environments are contaminated with multiple chemicals, not just one chemical. So it wouldn't be good for us to just measure one thing. So when we do this multiple measures approach, we're able to use new diagnostic technologies to get a better picture of what the animals are dealing with. Okay? One of the things we focus on is endocrinology, which I've been talking about a lot tonight. But we also deal with environmental biology and proteomics. And the other thing we're big on is collaborations. We're going to use all the resources that we have to make sure that we do good science and we get the right answer. Because of that, we collaborate with people like the EO Lab at Cal State Long Beach, which also deals with endocrinology, toxicology, and proteomics. And we also collaborate with the Hermes Technology Center, which is also following Cal Long Beach, and they focused on environmental chemistry and proteomics. By doing this sort of approach, we're able to not only measure the chemicals that are in the environments, we're able to measure the animals in the environment, and also measure the effects that are occurring at the cellular level using proteomics. So what's proteomics? Well, in a nutshell, proteomics is the ability for us to measure the proteins in each of the organisms at these locations. And why are the proteins important? Well, all the physiological functions that I talked about tonight, your stress, your growth, your reproduction, your development, it's all run and regulated by proteins. It's the proteins that are actually doing all the work to make those mechanisms function properly. So proteomics is pretty important. And so what we do when we do proteomic analysis is that we take a sample of an organism, and then we separate the proteins out by its pH, horizontally. And every protein has a specific size. And just like everyone's different, every protein is different. So then we separate the proteins out by mass, which gives us this nice little picture, which we like to call a protein profile. Now what we can do is we can say, all right, let's sort of highlight some of these important proteins and look at what the protein profile looks in a fish from a reference site. If that site is a reference site and it's clean, the protein profile is a normal profile. If we then go to a contaminated site or an impacted site and look at the protein profile, any changes that we see on this impacted site means that it has been caused by those contaminants that it's facing in the environment. And as you can see, in some cases, proteins completely disappear. In other cases, proteins become more prominent. And so these proteins are the key players in those physiological mechanisms that are being impacted by these contaminants. So what we do is we take that result and we use this powerful program to give us an idea of how much the proteins have changed. Once we are able to identify the actual proteins, we use this machine here called the MALDI-TOF-TOF, which basically zaps it and identifies the protein for us. It tells us exactly which protein was chosen. I don't want to scare you with this because this looks pretty scary. But this is a result that was done by a fellow lab researcher at Cal State Long Beach. And when she did her study, she identified 800 proteins when she looked at fish from an alpha site and compared them to fish from a reference site. Out of those 840 proteins, 110 proteins showed significant difference from the alpha compared to the reference site. She looked at those 110 and found that 81 of those proteins were identified by the MALDI-TOF with a high level of confidence. So this machine did its job. Out of those 81, she noticed that 61 of those proteins were important for metabolism, toxicological responses, oxidative stress response, and even altered signal. So 61 proteins that were key at dealing with these physiological mechanisms. Okay? That's the power of this technology, and that's the power of this tool, that we can look at hundreds, if not thousands, of proteins and identify all the proteins that are being affected by the contaminants at these sites. And then we can identify all of them. So this is the type of research that we're doing at the Colorado. Okay? This project, by the way, right now isn't funded. But both the people from Tidal Influence and PCC believe that this is really important work. And so we're still continuing on with this project. And what we've done is we've taken the fish from these locations and measured the protein profiles and compared them to fish from what we consider to be a reference site, in this case, Redwood City. And as you can see, for this guy, the Pacific Saccharum sculpin, there's major differences. Now, at the Colorado Lagoon, there's no protein here. At Redwood City, you see a slew of proteins there. We haven't identified the proteins yet, but these proteins could be in charge of growth. We don't know, right? These proteins can be in charge of something that's really important for this organism to live a nice, normal, healthy life. We did the same thing for shiner perch. And you see the same thing. You see certain proteins that change. Sometimes they're upregulated. Sometimes they're downregulated. Or in other cases, they're completely gone. Okay? But being able to identify these proteins and use them as what we call biomarkers is a very powerful tool. Every single protein now becomes a marker that tells us what contaminant is affecting it. And so the more proteins we identify, the bigger our library gets, the more powerful our tool becomes. So what we call this is bioanalytical screening methodology. And for PCC, this is a very sort of state-of-the-art, cutting-edge technology. were able to indicate the types of phenotypic effects, which deal with reproduction, growth, development, toxicological, and even metabolism. And it's able to indicate the active environmental factors. As I mentioned, we use these distinct biomarkers. Each protein can be considered a biomarker, or every hormone that we measure can be considered a biomarker. But these biomarkers will then reflect distinct environmental factors, such as the chemicals and the contaminants in the environment that are causing those biomarkers to change. And the development of each new biomarker adds to the subsequent power of this tool. Last but not least, we have the ability to potentially go to a site, measure the animals, and be able to tell what contaminants are present even before we're measuring the contaminants. It's a pretty powerful tool. And one of the other things we like to do at PCC is take this multifactorial approach. As I mentioned earlier, we don't just look at one thing because that would be wrong. Okay, there's many, many things impacting these environments. So what we do is we're able to measure thousands of chemicals. We then look at those chemicals and how it's impacting the actual proteins of the organisms, and how those proteins then in turn affect the normal endocrinology of the fish, whether it be the hormone levels or what have you. So by doing this, we feel that we're doing science the right way, and we're looking at a bigger picture versus just staring at a small little part of Mona Lisa. So I want to thank some of our supporters, USC Sea Grant, California Ocean Protection Council, Hermes, Cabrillo Marine Aquarium, San Francisco Estuary Institute, Orange County Sanitation District, and the National Science Foundation. But before I finish completely, I do want to take a few minutes to talk about our environmental education programs. Because although our research is one of the main things of our organization, our education is just as big a part of what we do. And one of the things that we do is we focus on working with lower performing schools and schools with limited resources at getting kids engaged in science. We also provide students with useful and interesting knowledge on environmental issues in marine science, and we work with the teachers to enhance the curriculum that they have to make sure that we promote hands-on learning for kids. Now, I've already talked a lot and already bored you guys to death, but I'm just going to talk a little more, okay? The pictures that you see up here are kids from Linwood Middle School. And Linwood Middle School is a low-performing school in both math and science and have very limited resources. We were able to get these kids some hands-on experience. And I'm just going to give you guys one quick story. I came into the school, and I did a dissection with this class. And this one girl took her fish, she took control of her group, and she cut that fish perfectly. Dissected the fish, she knew what each tissue was, she knew what it did, and she did a very meticulous job at it. And I was like, wow, that's really good. I took a bunch of pictures, great. Kids leave. I go to the teacher and I was like, wow, that girl did a really good job. And her response to me was like, that girl is my worst student in this class. She never pays attention. She's always fighting. She's a foster kid, so she's always being moved around. She hates coming to school, and she's never here. Unfortunately, because she is a foster kid, I never got to see her out in the field with these kids. She had moved. But hopefully what she learned in class, she carries on with her to wherever she's at. So it's those kids that we're also trying to reach. Everyone talks about, got the good kids, you got the bad kids. Every kid's important. We also have internship programs for both high school kids and college kids. And what we do and what I do is I take those students and I give them hands-on field experiences on actual research projects. This here is Annie Nash. She was one of my interns last summer. And in fact, the proteomes that you saw, the gels, all those proteins that you saw when I showed you the comparison between Colorado Lagoon and Redwood City, they did all that. I didn't do a single thing. I just sat back and enjoyed the ride. They did all the work for me. But the point is that we give them real life projects to work on. They're not just doing work to be work. They're actually working on real life projects. So they're able to do some of the work and expose them to state-of-the-art instrumentation and technology. They're also able to gain knowledge and work closely with leading scientists and researchers in that field. And then we also have programs where we take kids out into the field and they participate in field experiences. This allows them to become active and valued participants in important research projects. It also helps them build them to be stewards of the environment, and also develops their communication skills because it's their job to go out and talk to the people that we're working with. This is Antonio Navarro, and he's from Montebello, and he goes to Share High School. And that's him bleeding this white croaker. He participated in a project where we worked with the Bremen Marine Aquarium, where these kids were in charge of going to talk to the fishermen and talking to the fishermen about the effects that humans have on these fish. And it was his job to collect the blood and analyze the blood after. So these guys get hands-on experience. So, what can we do to help? Well, some quick bullet points before I let you guys go. Don't do that, okay? The last thing you want to do is act like there's nothing wrong, right? Unfortunately, we do have people just like this. Let's stick their hands in the sand. I personally have a friend, and it's frustrating. He thinks, well, I'm going to be dead in a couple years, who cares, and blah, blah, blah. I cleaned up the language, but that's basically what he says. Okay? But unfortunately, those types of people don't understand that when you actually cause change to happen, it does happen. When we banned DDT, it had a remarkable effect on the raptor population. When we banned PCBs, it caused certain bird populations to go back into Great Lakes. And when we also banned PCBs, it allowed the correlation between the decline of incidence in hermaphroditism in these frogs. So this is just a small list of what happens when you actually cause some change to occur. Things can get better, but we have to work at it. It was our job to mess this up, now it's our job to try to fix it. So how can we limit, or how can resources be used to limit exposures? Well, first, we have to be able to identify the compounds that are acting on fish and biota. Okay? I mentioned earlier, hundreds of thousands of chemicals, only less than 130 are being really monitored. But we have the capability to measure thousands of chemicals at a time. So we're doing that now. Eliminating the use of harmful compounds, that's obviously a big one, because if we can do that, maybe we can develop substitute compounds that are less effective or less dangerous. We also want to develop point source regulations and filters. That'll help sort of organize some of the chaos that we have out there. And also develop better techniques for testing and breakdown of compounds before they get to the environment. Right now, there's a lot of research being done on the environment and the effects on the environment, and this should continue. But we also need to do research on what we can do before that stuff gets out to the environment. That'll obviously help us out immensely. And now what can you do? Well, you all want to close your ears and your eyes. But don't flush it, okay? Whatever it is. If it's a chemical, if it's a detergent, cleaning product, medicine, don't flush it. There may be a better, more proper way of disposing of some of this stuff than flushing it, because sanitation districts are not going to get rid of chemicals. They're only going to get rid of biosolids and get rid of bacteria. Everything else is going to go to the ocean. Do you really need it? Well, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you not to take medical or take medicine, okay? Take your medication. But when you do have medication prescribed to you, whatever it is, ask your doctor if that's the amount you actually need. Because if you need ibuprofen and you're taking a 500 milligram pill, but you only really need 300, then that extra 200 milligrams is just going out into the ocean. And if you were to cut out 200 milligrams over a span of a year, you'd be cutting kilograms of that stuff going out into the ocean. And that's just one U. 20 million U's, and now you're talking about a lot of material going out into the environment. So also be supportive of research and education, whose efforts are directed at solving these important environmental problems. There's a lot of great organizations, aside from mine, that do really good work at research and educating the public at large about the stuff that we're doing. And also support science-based assessment and policy, which hopefully will get those larger organizations, those larger companies to also fall in line and regulate themselves so they're also doing their due part. Before I leave, there's a handful of people I want to thank, because without me, or without them, I'm sorry, there would be no me, okay? Vivian Wang, she's a great volunteer. She's been with me since the very beginning. Tammy Sanchez is helping out with a lot of the educational stuff. Catherine Cortez, she's my web designer. She does everything on the web. Mary Tran, she helped out with the initial organization and outreach programs. Sarah Heredia, Melissa Soriano, Gabriela Javier, Sam Videla, Christina Espino. They're my educational volunteers. They do a great job. They were some of the young ladies you saw in those pictures with those kids. Eric Dellinger, Annie Nash, Stephanie King, Stephen Lasco. They were my interns last year. They did all that proteomic work that you saw. Evan Lee, who's in the crowd, he might wave because he's very popular. He's the guy doing the thyroid disruption work up in San Francisco. Dwight Causey and Haley Zemel have helped me immensely in field collections and also analysis. And Kaiser Rodriguez, Elisa Hernandez, and Sarah Espito, they're my interns this summer, and they worked on that data that you saw from the Cattle Raw Lagoon, so they're doing a great job. I also want to thank Lincoln High School and Ms. Falaya, Linwood Middle School, Ms. Arellano and Mr. Lim, Montevideo High School and Ms. Yamaguchi for the outreach programs that we've done with their kids. Last but not least, I want to also thank our collaborators, the EO Lab at Kelsey Long Beach, Orange County Sanitation District, Tidal Influence, Hermes, Friends of the Colorado Lagoon, Council for Watershed Health, and Vancouver Aquarium Home Group also participated in some of the projects. And the last thing I'm going to tell you, or leave you with, is that PCC is not this grand organization. I'm not some huge entity. We don't have the funding that, you know, the Surfrider Foundation has or Gila Bay has. But one of the things we do have is that we have volunteers that really care about what we do. And every time we go out and we do work because we know it's important. You know, everything we do has a purpose, and every purpose that we have has a goal. And we're not going to stop doing the work that we are doing because we know it's important. So the one thing I can promise is that we're never going to stick our heads in the sand. All right. So with that, I want to thank you guys for sitting and not falling asleep. I want to thank some of my cohorts, some collaborators and friends who have been here supporting me. I also want to thank my family who showed up and made me really, really nervous tonight. Good for them. And I want to thank you guys for being here. So if you guys have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.